As the pastor undertakes his important ministry, he needs to reach some understandings about the nature of man. Some irreverent authorities have referred to man as a rational animal. However, although modern man has made tremendous progress in his intellectual discoveries, he is constantly confronted with the fact that although he might be called a rational animal, he is not altogether rational. In fact, most of his personal problems are in the area of his emotions. Now, emotions are primitive mechanisms which were necessary for early man in facing his rugged life. Living in primeval days, an individual had to be prepared for any eventuality, for an enemy tribesman or a ferocious animal that might leap upon him. Faced with these situations, primitive man had two alternatives. He could fight or flee, with either alternative calling for a tremendous burst of energy. Emotional reactions trigger the body's emergency system. An individual in a state of fear not only feels a certain way, but has a total physiological reaction. Adrenaline is poured into his body from the ductless glands, his heart beats more rapidly, the pupils of his eyes are dilated, the whole body is prepared for action, so that he can fight his enemy or flee from the situation. Investigations have shown that there are at least three effects of strong emotional reaction. 1. A person in the grip of an emotion can exert himself over a long period of time, and the normal processes of fatigue do not seem to prevail. Men in combat or other types of emergencies can go for long periods without sleep. 2. A second effect of emotional upheaval is to give a tremendous burst of strength. During a fire, a man in a state of fear picked up a safe and carried it outside. Later, it took 3 men to carry it back. 3. A third effect may be to make an individual insensitive to pain. An injured football player, for example, may go in the excitement of the game unaware of his injury. Because a minister shares the emotional nature with all mankind, the way in which he handles these complex emotional forces will be of the greatest importance. So significant is the emotional area of life that one psychiatrist has suggested that the minister and the psychiatrist have much in common. He says they have a common motivation for the practice of their professions, rooted in a human sympathy for the suffering and a desire to relieve human distress. They need the same perceptive skills and capacity for empathy. Both attempt to help troubled persons. They possess a similar belief in the dignity of man. Both seek to remove the stumbling blocks to personal integration and to build more satisfying social and spiritual relationships. And like the psychiatrist, the minister may welcome an intelligent interest in his inner life, which may promise to bring him increased satisfaction and so accept the discomfort of self-analysis. Despite all these similarities, there is one essential differentiating factor between the psychiatrist and the minister, and that is that the minister must begin his work in response to a call. As simple as this statement may sound, it introduces one of the most difficult aspects of the ministry, which can easily get the youthful minister off to an ambivalent start in his career. There are two entirely contradictory views of the call of God to full-time ministry, either at home or on the mission field. At one end of the continuum stands the idea that all Christians are called. And because all Christians are called, only those who are hindered from responding by some special circumstance are legitimately justified in not being ministers or missionaries. The idea is sometimes expressed that a call is an awareness of a need and a capacity to respond to that need. So has come the expression, surrendering to the ministry. The implication is that all men are called, but some refuse to respond. On the other hand, there is the idea put forth that no one should even contemplate the possibility of entering the ministry unless there is some impelling experience. The characteristic expression is, don't even think about the ministry unless God compels you to enter. This situation grows even more complex when the convinced would-be minister has to come to terms with the church in which he hopes to minister. This church may not be as convinced as he about the validity of the call and have some reluctance to issue what we might call an ecclesiastical call. Or the situation may be reversed. Some churches or individuals feel a person is called when he himself is not so sure. John Calvin, the famous reformer, entered upon his ministry in a most unusual way. The scholarly Calvin had decided to spend his life in study and research away from the hurly-burly of life. But Farrell knew the situation in Geneva and felt that Calvin was the only one who could handle it, so he set about to change Calvin's mind. Farrell urged Calvin to move into leadership in Geneva. As Calvin resisted his pleadings, the ardent advocate uttered a series of curses that he believed would fall upon Calvin if he refused to respond to the call. The language of Farrell was so terrifying that Calvin finally capitulated, moved into the city, and entered upon his historic ministry. The Scottish reformer John Knox had a somewhat similar experience. He went to the castle church to hear John Rough speak. As Rough preached, he suddenly looked into the congregation with a piercing eye. Singling out Knox, he declared in the name of God that Christ was calling Knox to the ministry, and he urged him not to refuse the vocation to which he was being called. The emphasis of Baptists on the congregation and the autonomy of the local church does not prevent a similar experience with the church being the mouthpiece. George W. Truett, one of Southern Baptist's greatest preachers, started out in life to be an attorney. He did a considerable amount of lay preaching, and everywhere he preached, people suggested he ought to be in the ministry. However, Truett made it clear that he did not aspire to the ministry, and even when preaching, he was careful not to stand behind the pulpit. Then he moved to White Rite, Texas, where he became the Sunday school superintendent and continued on with his lay preaching ministry. In that day, Saturday night meetings were the regular features of church life, and on one Saturday in the year 1890, a remarkable event transpired. As Truett approached the church, he could not help but notice the large number of people that had gathered and mentally speculated as to why this should be so. The meeting took its normal course, but as it drew to the conclusion, the oldest deacon, a man in frail health, stood to his feet and began to remind the church that there were some situations in which a church must act and some in which an individual must act. He then reminded his hearers that when an individual failed to take an important step, it was sometimes necessary for the church to act for him. The deacon went on to say that he had talked with many members of the church, and they were all convinced that George Truett should be ordained to the preaching ministry. He thereupon moved that the church form a presbytery to ordain Truett to the work of the ministry. Truett protested that he could not allow them to do this, but the individuals came by and urged him to proceed. He begged them to postpone their action, but they refused. So they proceeded to ordain Truett. Truett himself throughout life continually emphasized the individual's personal call, but the role of other people in his own experience was of the greatest significance. If a vocation involves a call having address and response, the process of address is variously conceived by groups of Christians in differing traditions. To hear the authentic voice amidst the babble of sounds of groups, ecclesiastical personalities, and the inward urges will require sincerity, simplicity of faith, and dedication of purpose. Once having leaped the hurdle of being able to satisfactorily declare that he is called, the would-be pastor may enter seminary and there discover that there are still some more questions about him. The response is often more than Isaiah's simple, "Here am I, send me." The general procedure now is for the newly called recruit to seek training in a seminary. It might be anticipated that within the seminary's walls that there would be found outstanding Christians with peace of mind and a clear sense of calling as they prepare themselves for a position of leadership. But if each individual were questioned, an amazing variety of experiences would be discovered. As with other areas of life, there is a variety of motives involved. In the book, The Advancement of Theological Education, Niebuhr, Williams, and Gustafson reported the results of an intensive visitation of seminary campuses, during which a close study was made of the personality patterns of students preparing for the ministry. While reporting these personality types, they warn us that the patterns are not static, and theological students of all people are in a constant state of change. From their findings, it is possible to say that there are 10 types of personality patterns amongst theological students. 1. Those under duress. There is the student who is in the seminary because someone else thought he'd be a good minister. Maybe a minister, a fond parent, or people within his own church. This individual is often worried and harried by lack of certainty about his calling. 2. Upset. A man may be suffering from deep wounds within himself. He thus seeks a theological education to heal his own disturbed mind and spirit. Some people have feelings of guilt and conceive that this guilt can only be expiated by giving a life of service to God. The obvious difficulty is that though there may be therapy within the seminary fellowship, the theological seminary is not in existence for the primary purpose of supplying psychotherapy. It should be noted that these investigators maintain there is no evidence that seminarians have more maladjusted personalities in their student bodies than do other educational institutions. 3. Manipulating. The student who functions well in interpersonal relationships may be drawn towards the ministry. He may have been a successful salesman or have worked in some other kindred occupation. He comes to feel that greater prestige would accrue to him from the position of church leadership. If he is just a careerist, the manipulation of people may have a particular attraction for him. His church life may or may not give him the opportunity for exercising his manipulative power. 4. The suspicious. A person may have prematurely tasted the fruits of success within church life as a boy evangelist, a dynamic youth leader, or a student movement executive. He comes to seminary because everybody insisted that a seminary training is necessary. He is not sure that he ought to be there, but he comes simply to fulfill the pro forma requirements of ministerial status. He often finds it difficult to fit into seminary life, having a sneaking suspicion that he knows much more than the theoretically minded professor. The future pathway is likely to be rocky if he does not learn to make adjustments that go with the hard and realistic grind of the ministry. 5. Protected. The man who decided for the ministry at an early age and who enjoyed the protection of the pre-ministerial group in college will sometimes find his way to the seminary. He may have the right vocabulary, but has feelings of uncertainty about launching into the rigorous experiences of church life. Niebuhr and his associates quote a historian as saying, "We need ministers who have a hard-headed realism." This type of student feels somewhat disappointed in life at the seminary. The future for him is far from bright. 6. Zealous. A zealous spirit characterizes the student who has found the message of the gospel and its saving power. Within him there burns an intense desire to share the good news with the world. The student often discovers in the course of his studies that he has oversimplified the issues of life and the message of the gospel. He has to come to the situation when he becomes aware of the totality of the gospel message. He will constantly face the temptation to be critical of his fellow students, especially those who are further along the way but seem to lack the zeal and enthusiasm which he knows to characterize his own life. He is always open to the temptation of embracing theological positions uncritically and may pass through several swings in his theological orientation. 7. Confrontation. Religion and theology present themselves as objective intellectual problems to a searching mind. And for a student, the theological school seems to be the place to pursue these problems. These sort of people very often become the theological eggheads, who despise all practical concepts and live only in terms of bull sessions. In these sessions, they have an answer for every argument, but when they become part of the church life, they often find that people are not interested in their intellectual concepts. The down-to-earth life of the ministry may be something of a bitter disappointment to them. 8. Humanitarian. An experience of a tragically disorganized society often leads a student to study for the ministry. He sees the church as the institution out of which will flow the healing processes for the social evils of our time. The student is often disappointed by the indifference of the church to social problems, and in his disillusionment leaves the ministry to study in one of the areas of the social sciences. 9. Searching. Frequently found in the present generation is the man seeking for a faith adequate to bring order into the intellectual and moral confusions which have characterized his previous personal and academic experience. He is frequently uncertain about the workings within the church, although he has a certain loyalty to it. And 10, maturing. Fortunately, there is the rare student of mature faith and judgment who lives in the knowledge that it is God who saves and justifies. The student is seeking to become an adequate servant for his Lord and will faithfully represent him in the work of the ministry. Now, when we look over these 10 types of personalities within a seminary, we will see that behavior of any type has multiple causations. This is particularly true of a decision to respond to a call to the ministry. In his investigation among theological students, Southard said that most of them had taken from 1 to 3 years to make their decision to enter a church vocation. He further found that with the majority of them, this decision was only made after much emotional inner struggle. The investigations of these three men give further ample evidence of this turmoil. Problems faced in the theological school pale into insignificance as the minister takes up his work within the church. An article in a national magazine some years ago was titled, "Why I Quit the Ministry," and it revealed the shock and the disillusionment of the young minister as he faced the down-to-earth problems of church life. There are a number of characteristics that we see in church life which someone has called the vocational neuroses of the ministry. Let us look at some of these difficulties. 1. There is egocentricity through pampering. As soon as a young man in the church announces that he feels called to the ministry, there is a good possibility that he will find himself set apart and noted as a person who is particularly pious. Later, he may get special tuition rates at college, free education at the seminary, and the adulations of kind ladies in his congregation. The result may be that he will become dependent, always expecting people to help him, and becoming very sensitive to any form of criticism. 2. The number and character of his masters. The church is a voluntary organization and frequently has highly individualistic members within its ranks. There are often groups within the church who represent particular points of view and feel that the minister should fit in with their group's plans. It has been said that the democratic leader is always on trial. And the minister discovers the reality of that statement as he tries to weld the diverse personalities in his congregation into a cohesive group. 3. Competition with members of his own profession. There is a strong spirit of competition in church life. Churches are measured against each other in size of plant, money in the budget, number of baptisms, members in Sunday school, and in many other ways. The young minister is often frustrated with this competition. He may feel that his church is older or younger, in a poorer situation, or has had a more checkered history than another more successful church. Consequently, he builds a strong resentment to denominational structure that encourages such competition. But he is often dependent upon these leaders for recommendations to other churches, and so he has to repress his hostility. 4. Temptation to indolence. The minister does not have a clock to punch. Very often he is given a membership in a country club or some other social group. If he doesn't learn to discipline himself, he may get to the place where he just keeps up an impressive front and does very little real work. 5. Economic stringency. The minister has worked at getting through college, then attending a seminary. When at last he gets his position in a church, he may receive a very ordinary salary. He often has unseen benefits, but these are not obvious in his salary check. He is always tempted to compare himself with the doctor or the lawyer who did about the same amount of preparatory work, but is so much better paid. The 6th factor, exposure of self and family to social scrutiny and criticism. The minister and his family live in a glass house, and their affairs are open to the congregation's inspection. In some church situations, they know how much salary he earns and many details of his life which are normally a man's own personal secret. His children are expected to live by higher standards than most of the other children in the congregation. The situation is liable to breed a smouldering resentment about the unfairness of the life of the ministry. Now, as in other types of work, there are two sides to the work of the ministry. In its public aspect, it provides attention and adulation and sincere affection from many people. On the other hand, there are few callings in which an individual has to put up with so much pettiness and littleness of spirit. Jeremiah, the weeping prophet, is frequently the personification of the inner anxiety with which the pastor must cope. Now, what type of person does best in this difficult situation? In an effort to discover the personality characteristics of the successful church leader, I carried out a study in the School of Religious Education at Southwestern Seminary, Fort Worth, Texas. A group of 323 students participated in a program of field work which involved working in church situations under supervision. From this number were chosen the 30 best students who were classified as superior and the 20 whose field work was of a low quality and they were classified as poor. Three psychological tests were taken by each of the students. An item analysis was made to discover the way in which the 1,091 questions had been answered. By statistical analysis, items answered in a significantly different manner by the two groups were ascertained. Examination and categorization of the items revealed the following personality traits. 1. Suggestibility. The poor students were apparently more suggestible than the superior. Working with Roman Catholic seminarians, William C. Beer utilized the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, and following a simple tallying procedure, he found that the poorly adjusted students had a proneness to consistently mark items true. Beer suggested that this was generally a tendency with less well-adjusted personalities. In the Southwestern study, the same trend was noted. The students who did poorly in their church work frequently checked items as true, while the superior students appeared to discriminate more carefully, checking a large number of items as false. Apparently, the religious yes man is not a success, and it could be that he lacks the attitude needed for adequate leadership. 2. Self-confidence. Lack of self-confidence characterized the poor group. Their responses showed a strong emotional overtone. They felt disappointments keenly, harbored a sense of being misunderstood, and were much worried about their moods. Their attitude of uncertainty was shown in the stated necessity of having to rewrite letters before mailing them. On the other hand, the superior group manifested a feeling of self-confidence. They checked that they liked being the first to wear new fashions, enjoyed taking responsibility, delighted in developing plans, felt sure of themselves, and took pleasure in starting activities within the group. The factors all had to do with ego strength, apparently as important in leadership in church work as it is in other areas of life. 4. Sociability. Sociability was another characteristic of the superior group of students. Their preference ran to parties and socials, interviewing prospects and selling, living in the city, and enjoying amusements where there was a crowd of people. They were joiners, stating that they belonged to a number of societies and felt drawn towards politics. On the MMPI, they had a high masculine femininity score. While this scale has been seen to indicate homosexuality, it has been more recently considered to be a measure of the willingness to mix with people of the opposite sex. By way of contrast, the poor group showed a tendency to withdraw from group activities. At parties, they liked to sit by themselves or just be with one person. They avoided crowds whenever possible, often had feelings of loneliness, had few intimate friends, and their feelings were easily hurt. It is also almost axiomatic that a leader who influences and leads a group must have a love for people and a willingness to be with them. 5. Emotionalized attitudes. In their emotionalized attitudes, another difference showed up. The poor students indicated a proneness to excessive emotionality. Their responses denoted anxiety about money and business, swings between pleasant and unpleasant moods, and a frequently experienced state of excitement. Their feelings were easily hurt, and they worried much about their mistakes. In contrast, the superior group revealed a more rational and objective attitude in their relationships. They were not usually self-conscious, and they were able to meet emergencies quickly. They enjoyed reading editorials in the newspaper, and they showed their objectivity by indicating that they were reticent in confidential and semi-confidential affairs. 6. Creativity. The attitude of the members of the two groups showed up towards their work. They were different. The superior group looked for opportunities for promotion, liked freedom in working out their own method of doing a job, enjoyed teaching others, and were mainly concerned about work which was interesting, even though the remuneration was not high. With the poor group, the emphasis was upon tangible results and more closely delineated tasks, work involving few details, which was steady and permanent with regular hours. The joy of work is vital in vocation. Work should bring its own reward, even apart from salary. 7. Compulsiveness. The personality trait which stood out clearest in the responses of the two groups was a bent towards pathological compulsiveness seen in the poor group. Compulsiveness has been defined as an irresistible inner force compelling the performance of an act, without or even against the will of the individual performing the act. The poor group told of periodic urges to do something harmful and shocking, and how that on occasions they felt like picking a fist fight with someone. They also stated that an unpleasant thought sometimes went through their mind for days. There was no indication of this same pathological compulsiveness among the superior group. Now, from this survey, it becomes obvious that the pastor faces a complex task, a challenge that will demand much of him, and more, in fact, than most of the other challenges that individuals get in their life's calling.